It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, after further review, students taking the SAT college admissions test will not be given an adversity score after all. We'll find out why the College Board scrapped that idea and what they're planning on doing instead. First, a federal appeals court ruled this week that a lawsuit brought against Spirit Airlines over ambiguous fees would be able to proceed. The lawsuit was brought by more than 20 travelers who say they were blindsided by hidden bag fees when buying tickets for Spirit flights through a third-party travel website, things like Expedia or Priceline. Spirit is not the only airline that charges for bags and other amenities, but the lawsuit could change how all airlines charge their customers in the future, depending on the outcome of the suit. Seth Kaplan is a transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now. Seth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, great to be here.
Well, Seth, flesh out this lawsuit for us a little bit.
Yeah, so the lawsuit isn't so much about whether Spirit should be allowed to charge these fees. It's about whether it's clear in advising passengers about that. And a little more specifically, Rob, the suit distinguishes between what passengers find when they go to Spirit's own website and what they learn when they buy Spirit tickets on other websites, sites like Expedia, let's say, where you compare different airlines and often just buy whatever's cheapest. Well, you know, if you did that on Expedia, you could perhaps buy a Spirit ticket because it's cheapest, as it often is, without realizing, according to the lawsuit, that you're going to have to pay for some other things that you might not have to pay for on another airline. Early on in with all of this, Spirit charging first for checked bags. They were an early airline to do that. I mean, now almost every airline does that. And later, even for large carry-on bags, people complained at first that it just wasn't obvious at all that they were going to have to do that, even on Spirit's own website. And as things evolved, look, if you go to their website now, it's pretty clear that you're going to have to pay for those things. It's right in your face. I mean, look, partly for their own good, of course, they're trying to get you to pay for those things, collect more money. But, you know, either way, hard to buy a ticket on Spirit's own website without realizing that you're going to have to pay for almost everything other than safe travel. And it's gotten better on those other websites. There are notifications now that things are different on this airline and, as you mentioned, other airlines. But they always sort of trail Spirit's own website in terms of just how clear it is. You know, they're designed to compare different airlines. And yeah, there's a matrix about what you get and what you don't get. But they're not mainly optimizing for telling you all about Spirit Airlines and how it's different.
Right. Shopping for air travel online, especially these comparison sites, you are not comparing apples to apples in many cases when you see airline A's fees versus airline B's fees because of these extra charges, right?
Exactly. And, you know, shopping for airfare, yeah, has become a lot more complicated over the past decade, right? I mean, what's the cheapest airline? Well, it kind of depends on who you are, right? Are you a heavy packer or not? Look, I mean, it's not just Spirit, right? We all know bags fly free on Southwest, right? Well, I mean, come on, they're not really free. They're included, right? And what can sometimes be a more expensive ticket. Now, if you're going to check two bags, if you're traveling with a family and everybody's checking lots of bags, then Southwest is very often the cheapest airline. If you're a light packer, it might not be. So it is possible to get the best deal on Spirit or to get the best deal on an airline somewhere in between, you know, the American, United, Deltas of the world. Kind of depends on who you are. And no question, the bag math especially has gotten a lot more difficult, especially ever since they started charging for carry-ons, which, again, it's not just Spirit. The other ultra low-cost airlines, as they're called, so I'm talking about Allegiant, I'm talking about Frontier, they do that too. And United Airlines, when you buy what they call a basic economy ticket, they charge also for a carry-on. They don't let you bring a large carry-on like a rollerboard, anything that requires overhead bin space on with the fare, even though American and Delta, with their basic economy tickets, do include that. So, yeah, it is rather confusing, particularly for people who don't fly all the time. And they feel like every time they buy an airline ticket, the game has changed.
Talking to Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now, about a lawsuit against one airline company, Spirit Airlines, that could have an impact on other airlines. It's about how charges are laid out, especially on third-party websites for extras, like bringing a bag onto the plane. Now, Seth, this lawsuit, the news peg here isn't that the court ruled for or against anybody, but it is significant, it sounds like, that they actually said, yeah, this suit can go ahead. That wasn't a sure thing, right?
Right. This is a circuit court allowing this lawsuit to go forward, reversing the view of a lower court. Now, look, some of this is just about legalities, legal technicalities. I'm not a lawyer, to be clear. So part of what Spirit is arguing here is just whether federal law allows this kind of a lawsuit, right? So it's not all about, and this is often the case with lawsuits, right? You hope that, you know, common sense and the law go in tandem, and often they do, but sometimes, yeah, there are just things where you get into some of the legal technicalities also. And as I said before, the lawsuit doesn't appear to question the whole practice of the fees, so essentially to question Spirit's business model. These are people who are saying, we didn't know. And in some cases, we're hit with big fees, a woman being charged $100 at the gate for a bag that she didn't pay for in advance. It's far less than that if you do pay in advance. And Rob, I have to say, it can be confusing even for people. This isn't only about people who have never been on an airplane before. I mean, I myself got hit by this a couple months ago where, so we were going to, I live in Washington, D.C. We were traveling to Bozeman, Montana. And I bought for my family and a one-way ticket on Delta on the way there and on Frontier, one of those ultra low-cost carriers, on the way home. So with Delta, I had a credit card that meant that I didn't have to pay bag fees. I said, you know what, we've got a lot of stuff. We can check two bags instead of one. We're three people traveling together. Each person could check one bag without paying. So, we're not paying for the checked bag. Let's take two, whereas we usually try to get all our stuff into one checked bag. Well, I forgot that we're coming on to Frontier and I had paid when I booked for one checked bag. But because I had the second checked bag, I had to pay an extra $38, because it was a bag to begin with and I hadn't. It would have been a little cheaper had I paid earlier. And I fly all the time. I know I'm on the radio talking about this stuff with you and nationally, but I got caught in it. So yeah, there's no question. It's different, maybe not so different from other industries, right? Where every store has its own policies. Maybe in that regard, it's not so different, but it is different from how it used to be to buy airline tickets. And again, what's different is that you don't go to one website, again, talking about the Expedias, the Kayaks of the world, where they compare airline tickets. It's not as if you go to one website usually and compare, Target and Walmart, right? Usually you're dealing directly with those stores or with an online retailer like Amazon. Whereas in the airline industry, you do have these websites that sort of try to help us compare all the different airlines, but the comparisons are getting more difficult. To be clear, they're doing a better job than they used to do of warning people, but no question, it's still less clear. And back when the lawsuit was first filed, it was probably even less clear than it is now, than it is when you go straight to those airlines' websites.
What has led the industry, the airline industry, to separate out charges like this instead of, okay, you pay your one fee and you get this and that's it, to, okay, we're breaking down each item individually?
Yeah, unbundling, they call it, right? Not so different, again, from the way you buy other kinds of product, but very different from how you've used to buy airline tickets. So the way airlines see it, Rob, is basically, look, the old way never made sense in their view, at least the view of most airlines, Southwest, really the holdout in sticking with a highly bundled product. They say, look, it wasn't good for airlines. They're making a lot more money this way, but they say it also wasn't good for consumers because you had basically light packers subsidizing heavy packers, right? Again, using Southwest as the example, and it could work out well flying them. But if you're not taking much and you're paying the same amount as somebody who's taking a lot, essentially you're kind of sharing the cost of that other person's bag, right? So the way airlines see it is, why would you want to do that? In the same way as, sure, there's such a thing as an all-you-can-eat buffet, but generally you go into a restaurant and if you eat and drink more, you're probably going to pay more, right? The person eating, a sandwich and drinking a glass of water doesn't want to pay the same as the person eating a steak and drinking a glass of wine. So why would you want to do that on an airline? That's their position. Again, it's not altruistic. This has also worked very well for them because the way it's generally worked is base airfares – are, if you try to hold everything constant, which is hard to do, but base airfares are probably somewhat lower than they would be if everything were still bundled. But the fees add up to so much that you know, in the end, airlines are more profitable. So they say, hey, win-win, good for us, but also good for people who, you know, who just pay for what they use now. And that's basically their view, that that this is just what always made sense, but it just sort of took a crisis, especially the one last decade where fuel got very expensive and then you had the global economic crisis, to kind of force them to make changes that that in their view they probably should have made long ago.
We're talking to Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now. We're talking about a recent lawsuit facing Spirit Airlines over carry-on bag fees and how the airline industry has changed how it charges customers over the last decade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the fees airlines tack onto their plane tickets? Have you been surprised at some point in your traveling life by unexpected baggage fees, maybe that you had to pay at the airport to get on the plane? Do you have questions about how all of this works? Do you think regulations need to change? Are you okay with things the way they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about airline fees with Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now. A federal appeals court ruled that Spirit Airlines will need to face a lawsuit that challenges so-called hidden bag fees charged to customers through third-party travel websites. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been surprised by fees like this? What was your experience when you're shopping for air travel, if you do that? Do you have to set up a spreadsheet to compare who you're going to pay what and see what the best deal really is when you figure out all the fees and how they work together? Do you think there need to be federal regulations? People have thrown those ideas out there. Or is it the company's prerogative to charge what they want, how they want? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard Seth from James on Facebook, who writes, they need to pass laws requiring airlines to not charge for carry-ons. Has this ever been talked about at the federal level when they review airline regulations?
Yeah, James isn't the only person who feels that way. There have been discussions, and there have been new regulations over the years, in recent years, including that have bolstered consumer protection. You know, one is the fact that they have to give you 24 hours to cancel a ticket after you purchase it. That would be one that did happen. Others like that. That's those carry-ons are still something where it's just an airline by airline decision right now. And by the way, James isn't the only one who feels that way. Lost my train of thought there for a second. Oh, I was going to say just a tip in terms of doing the bag math, as I mentioned earlier, not so easy. With carry-ons, they cost roughly as much on the airlines that charge for them as a checked bag. But a carry-on bag, of course, is typically much smaller than a checked bag. It can't be nearly as large. Depending on the airline, a checked bag can be up to 40 or up to 50 pounds without paying something extra. Typically up to 40, by the way, on airlines like Spirit, Frontier, and Allegiant. That's something else to watch out for. So if you're traveling together in particular, we've all gotten so trained to think about checked bag fees that we were doing for a number of years, anything to sort of just make sure to carry everything on and check as few bags as possible, that with these airlines and with these fares I mentioned earlier, basic economy on United works this way too. It's kind of the opposite, because you're better off sort of jamming everything into one big checked bag. Again, particularly two or three people traveling together, if you get all your stuff into one checked bag, than carrying on two or three bags. On Spirit, believe it or not, it typically costs more to carry on a large bag than to check a bag, which can be much larger. It's like $5 more to carry on a rollerboard, you know, fits in the bin than it is to check a much larger bag. With other airlines, it might be the same or even a few bucks more to check a bag. But again, if you're facing those carry on fees, think in terms of, you know, how few checked bags can I take rather than how many carry ons can I take. And keep in mind, by the way, that's small items, so a purse or you know, a small backpack that fits under the seat in front of you, those you still don't have to pay. They have their little bag measuring boxes there where you know they might check your bag. Check is the wrong word there. They might inspect your bag, but generally speaking, if it looks like something that you can stuff under the seat in front of you, you could do it. So that's part of the game too. You know, whatever you can stuff in a small backpack, whatever you can stuff in your jacket here as we get toward fall and winter, that's typically fine. It's just going to be those large carry-ons that you have to pay extra for.
It really seems like the incentive structure changed at some point there, Seth. It seemed like for a while airlines were really trying to push you to not carry something on. They were the higher fees, or not to check bags. Those were the higher fees. Okay, so everybody's fighting for the overhead space. Now all of a sudden there are new rules kind of pushing you in the other direction. Is that just my perspective, or is that really happening?
It's really happening, and it's intentional. You know, Spirit, back when they became the first to charge for the carry-ons, first in this country anyway, said that it had gone too far, that because people were trying to carry the kitchen sink aboard the plane, that was the new bottleneck, right? And so they said, hey, we're going to try to rebalance this. Of course, they didn't do that by not charging for check bags anymore. They did by charging for all of it. And I will say, having flown them and the others, yeah, I mean, they kind of have rebalanced it now to where people are more agnostic about perhaps checking a bag. So it's all, you know, we all respond to these to these financial incentives for sure. When you fly Southwest, you don't have that crunch. For them, it's for a different reason, right? Nobody's paying for any of the bags, so you could just check a bag if you want to. When you fly the ultra low cost airlines or increasingly United, the boarding seems a little bit faster because of they've done it with the stick rather than Southwest's carrot. And with everybody else, it's still how much can I carry aboard? And you end up getting at the end there, often the gate agent saying, hey, we'll check the bag for free. Just get on the plane. Let's get out of here.
Seth Kaplan is with us, transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now, looking at airline baggage fees and policies. A lawsuit in the news against Spirit Airlines. They're not the only airline watching that lawsuit. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Maren is with us in Berlin. Maren, hi.
Hi. So I fly Delta all the time, and I flew them a couple weeks ago, and what they do now is when you get up to the bag, to the gate, they say anybody willing to check through their carry-on through to their destination, you can board with the first group at no charge for your bag. So I kind of cheat the system, and I go and tell them, heck yeah, I'll check it through and pick it up at the baggage claim at my destination. I don't have to carry it through the connecting flight airport, which is nice, and I can board first. So,
Maren, thanks a lot for that call and that suggestion. Seth, can we count on that happening every single time, though?
Maren, yeah, sort of mutually beneficial there, right? Obviously, if Delta's doing it, it's because they've decided it's good for them, but as you said, good for you too. Look, I think they're all gonna they don't want it to get to where people. To where you have kind of a perverse incentive for people to all game the system. But to a degree, this is just like all the rest of what airlines do, right? They're sort of testing our price sensitivity, right? When are you going to buy an airline ticket? That's all based on sort of how much of a discretionary traveler you are. And same thing here, right? What are you willing to do? How creative are you willing to be to avoid fees? So to a degree, they're fine with that. You know, in the end, if Maren's willing to take the bag through security, right? So it's a little less convenient because she has to do that at least. She can't just check it at the counter. She's willing to do that and wait for that to happen, which she described, which, I mean, yeah, she's right. That happens a lot. And if it also helps the airline in terms of boarding the plane more quickly, then kind of works out okay for everybody. And with all the billions of dollars that Delta is earning these days, apparently they're not missing Marin's bag fee revenue.
Marin, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Bob with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Good afternoon. I want to bring up a quick incident. I understand about the fees and charging, but we had an incident, and it comes down to the point where I wish airlines would work with people for common sense issues. For example, we went to the counter. One of our bags was 47 pounds. The other bag was 53 pounds. And they said, we have to charge resale for 53. And I said, well, wait a minute. Both bags are 100 pounds, which is the limit. And I don't think the guy at the counter, being very nice here, I don't think he understood the math. So he made us say, well, take the 3 pounds out of the one bag and put it in the other bag. So they're both 50 pounds. And I said, again, they're going to be on the same plane. So it'll be 100 pounds. Meanwhile, everyone behind us is screaming, hey, I'm going to be late for my plane. I'm going to be late for my plane. At the end, we took the 3 pounds out. So both bags were 100 pounds. And we made people, probably at least two or three people, miss their plane.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. I did some bag rebalancing on my last flight. Basically the same math. What do you think, Seth?
We've all been there. Yeah. I've seen more flexible agents when a bag is, 1, 2, 3 pounds over. And especially in that situation with the 53 and the 47, I've seen them, Yeah, use some common sense. Look, that is their job, to be clear, and there are reasons for the 50 pounds. Once bags get heavier, they have to handle them in a special way. But in that particular case, I probably would have felt as Bob did and hoped, even though, yes, that's the rule, that they would just sort of move everybody through, knowing that it's all going to work out fine for everybody, the airline and the passengers alike.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Seth, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. A pleasure.
That's Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now. He joins us today to talk about the recent news that Spirit Airlines can face a lawsuit. That lawsuit's going ahead from travelers alleging the company wasn't transparent about their baggage fees, especially on these third-party websites where you can shop and compare different rates. You can still share your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Earlier this year, we talked about the College Board's plan to assign adversity scores to all students who take the SAT college admissions tests. The scores would have measured socioeconomic inequality where students live using 15 different factors that would then be boiled down to a single number. Colleges could consider those figures when deciding which students to accept. 50 colleges used them last year as part of a beta test. But hold on, there was some backlash to the idea, and now the College Board says it's scrapping that proposal. But the group is still trying to figure out how to deal with the impact of inequality on their test results. Scott Jasek is an editor at Inside Higher Ed. Scott, thanks for joining us again.
Hi.
Well, I give kind of a nutshell version, Scott, of how this adversity score would have worked. Can you flesh it out a little for us?
Sure. Well, what the College Board is doing now is they're going to give everyone two scores, one for their high school and one for their neighborhood. And that will allow colleges that want to use that information. The system will be called Landscape, not Adversity. And the scores will be available to students, not just to colleges, as the original plan was.
Why did they back away from the original idea, which just would have been this one score, as you say, that the students wouldn't have seen?
I think there was just a lot of opposition to it. Students said, wait, you're going to have a score on me that I can't see, that I can't object to. And so it just was not very defensible. And so the College Board backed down.
And one point to make clear, and I think we talked about this when the adversity score idea came out, at no point was this going to be a thing where they said, okay, because of your background, your actual SAT score number is going to go up or down, correct?
Right. The SAT score is the SAT score, period.
Why is the College Board wrestling with this idea, whatever outcome they come up with, to have some sort of measure of the student's background that goes alongside their SAT score?
There are a few reasons. One is that the SAT scores totally are correlate with wealth. That doesn't mean that a a poor student always does poorly or that a rich student does well, but they do better. And colleges are dropping the SAT and the ACT too, I should say. Colleges are going test optional. So you've got that combination of factors. Plus, you've got a big affirmative action case involving Harvard University that's going to come down any day now, and many people think that will make it harder for colleges to consider SAT scores.
And Scott, just in this last week, it seems like there's this passel of news and opinion related to what you're talking about, the impact of social inequality on SAT scores. There's a new book out, and I think you've written
yes.
about that. There's a admissions officers are writing op-eds. A lot of people are worried that, hey, these exams, all they do is measure wealth.
They are worried by that. Now, the College Board denies that, but nonetheless, many colleges are dropping the SAT as a result of the worries, and many people think that the SAT and the ACT are just not helpful to students trying to go to college.
And yet, there are a bunch of high school juniors, including in my household, who are going to take the ACTs this year, and going to take them pretty seriously, right? They're not dead and irrelevant yet.
Yes. I mean, it's coming, and a student who wants to apply where no SAT score is required probably can come up with some good options. But the students still want to be able to apply anywhere, and so they need to look at where the SAT is required.
Talking to Scott Jasek, editor at Inside Higher Ed, about college admissions exams, the SAT in particular, the College Board, the group that runs the SAT, changing a plan to have what they call an adversity score that went alongside the SAT numbers. Now they're going to have this landscape score. The students can see that. It rates their where they grew up and where they went to high school. Scott, what is the hope or what is the idea that the College Board is offering for what college admissions officers will do with this landscape score?
So the idea is that, you know, let's say you got an SAT score, whatever, and you are poor, that then they would use the landscape score and say, well, actually, you know what, I'm going to assume that he did better or she did better. The problem with that is that students right now, our high schools are known to their colleges, so and the colleges know about a lot of this information.
Let's bring on a caller. Jennifer is with us in Appleton. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, why would they use the where they live that score for where they live? Because if somebody is poor, that does not mean that they would not do well in college. That would be like sort of a bad way to...
I gotcha, Jennifer. And in a way, they're trying to sway it in the opposite direction of what Jennifer's worried there, I think, Scott.
Yes, they're trying to encourage colleges to to possibly admit such a student. And many colleges are looking for a talented, low-income student, and so they probably would admit such students.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Jennifer, with that question. And yeah, in some of the essays I'm seeing, including from admissions officers, the concern they have is, okay, we got a student here with a 3.5 grade point, student there with a 3.5 grade point. Student A is from a great prep school that trains them to take the SAT and the ACT. They get a higher score. School
absolutely.
B doesn't do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this could allow them to compare them.
What is going to happen? What are you watching for next? We've got this landscape score, but it doesn't seem like this is going to be the end of this discussion, Scott.
No, although I actually think it's not going to have as huge an impact as people worried about. I think the publicity about the adversity index didn't go well for the College Board. And so I think that, they'll put it out there. Colleges may use it. Colleges won't.
What do we know about the ability of SAT? Actually, let's bring on a caller. David is with us in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. So I just wanted to ask you, so SAT and ACT scores for college admission being one thing, but have we ever looked at correlation between SAT, ACT in like career success? I would like to think maybe there's more to SAT and ACT than just saying poor kids don't have the opportunity to do well versus wealthy kids do well because they have all this means. Maybe it is some sort of an aptitude.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, what do you think?
So the SAT and the ACT say that they predict first year in college academic success. That's all they say. Now many of them, many students do well in their careers, but it's based on other factors.
David, thanks for the call. Do we know how the SAT and ACT do as predictors of that first year academic success?
They say they do well, but people who are pushing for test optional admissions say that you can do pretty much as good without them.
And the mystery here, Scott, is how do you predict how a student's going to do in college? Is there something that everybody agrees, like, yeah, this is a good predictor of academic success?
Grades in academic courses in high school. That's everything.
But can't that vary from school to school?
It does vary from school to school. And so people will assume that a college admissions officer is going to consider that. But when they consider that, it counts.
How about the idea of having a diverse student population? Maybe that means ethnic and racial diversity, but maybe it means urban, rural, low income, high income, mm-hmm. whatever. Is that something that schools are trying to do and doing successfully to have a mix of people from these different backgrounds?
It's something that schools are trying to do. I'm not sure how success.
What are some of the things you're watching that schools are trying to do to make that happen?
They're trying to admit students who they wouldn't normally admit, and that produces this level of diversity that they don't have. But the very top schools are very hard to get into, and it's hard to get into them without good SAT scores.
And then if the schools are faced a challenge, if they bring in students they wouldn't usually admit in an effort to get students from different backgrounds, people sue them sometimes, right?
That's certainly what's happening at Harvard.
When is this new SAT landscape score going to be taking effect?
It's going to be taking effect next year, and so it'll be out then.
And is it going to influence the way kids take the SAT or
Well, when kids take the SAT, it's the same SAT. There is nothing different about it because of landscape. It may affect when they get their scores. It may affect what students think about the SAT or whether they decide even to submit the SAT.
In the mid to long run, Scott, do you expect to see the trend of schools just saying goodbye to the ACT and SAT to continue?
Yes. I don't know that it will go all the way, but I think it will continue. The University of Chicago last year dropped the SAT, and Colorado College dropped the SAT. Literally, every week there's a new college dropping the SAT, but it's notable when it is colleges that are competitive in admissions.
Is there just this sort of crisis of conscience going on campuses all over the country when it comes to these tests?
I think there is. It is very difficult for admissions officers. But at many colleges that have lots of applicants and don't have a lot of money, the SAT remains a used tool.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye.
That's Scott Jasek, editor at Inside Higher Ed. We talked to them about the College Board's decision to do away with plans to assign adversity scores to students taking the SAT, replacing them with a slightly different landscape score that students can actually see. They couldn't have with those adversity scores. Police in Kenosha County have uncovered a major operation that made counterfeit vaping cartridges filled with THC oil derived from marijuana. Two brothers are in custody in connection with the operation, which authorities are calling one of the biggest of its kind in the country. The bust comes as public health officials are warning people not to use vaping products, especially bootleg products, after more than 450 cases of lung disease and 6 deaths that could be related to vaping chemicals. And yesterday, President Trump said he wants to see a ban on flavored e-cigarettes nationwide. Raquel Rutledge is an investigative reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Raquel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you report, police raided this operation located in Bristol where these counterfeit cartridges were being made. Can you talk about the size and scale of this operation?
Well, it sounds like it was quite a massive operation. Police found more than 30,000 vape cartridges filled with a gram of THC each, and then also nearly 100,000 empty vape cartridges that they were, you know, preparing to sell. So it was big. It's one of the biggest counterfeit THC cartridge operations that they've seen.
And two brothers were arrested. It sounds like they had a staff working with them on this.
Yeah, that's right. It sounds like they had as many as 10 people that were employed that actually had time cards that they filled out, and they paid them about $20 an hour to take little syringes and then fill up these cartridges. They had about 57 mason jars full of THC oil that police suspect they got from California. And so, yeah, they had these workers, and they were in a condominium that they had rented under a fake name, allegedly that they had. You know, police can't say for sure that it's them who rented this place, but they do know that the condominium was rented under a fake name, and that's where this operation was run.
And we know, and you've reported in the past, that police have been looking for the source of these illegal cartridges on the market. This may not be the only source, of course. Can you talk about what police had been looking at before this arrest?
Yeah, I mean, we wrote a story, I guess it's been maybe a couple of weeks ago, about another operation that was running out of Milwaukee downtown. Some folks were living in those high-end apartments on the north end on Water Street. And they were running an operation where they were doing the same kind of thing, counterfeit cartridges, and they were selling 20,000 per month, I think they said. And it was, you know, again, bringing in up to $2 million per month by making these counterfeit cartridges. So it's not a new, I mean, it sounds like 2018 was kind of a big year. The police in Kenosha said that the brothers in Kenosha, they suspected had been working in this operation since January 2018. So it's unclear, you know, why the uptick in illnesses now or if any of these cartridges are, you know, for sure linked with any of the illnesses.
Can you talk about how police found out about this Bristol operation? It was kind of a thin thread that ultimately led them there.
It really was. I mean, they're really crediting the parents of a Waukesha area teenager who, you know, who had one of the cartridges, and the parents just felt like it was really important to hold this young man accountable. And so they took him to the police department and, you know, and then they just started, you know, sharing information about where he got his cartridge, et cetera. So it really, you know, again, it was the parents were to credit for bringing it forward.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge, investigative reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a big police raid on an illegal bootleg vaping cartridge operation, one of the biggest so far known in the country, possibly. And Raquel, you mentioned we've had illnesses and deaths around the country, cases here in Wisconsin of people getting sick from some kind of vaping project. Is that adding new urgency to try to track down the source and distribution of these illegal cartridges?
It really is. I mean, epidemiologists with the CDC and FDA are all working together to try to really pinpoint what is it that's causing these illnesses. I mean, in New York, they were finding that the commonality in some of their cases was some vitamin E oil additive. And again, while that might be safe to ingest and eat, you know, it's some of these things that are, you know, people say, oh, well, it's just vitamin E, whatever. It's not meant to be inhaled. So inhaling, you know, they definitely were the one thing they can say about these cases. They all look to have some sort of chemical exposure type injury in the lungs, but they still have not been able to pinpoint specifically what it is that is causing this lung damage.
And another open question, it sounds like, with this Bristol operation, this is the production center. It sounds like police are still trying to track down, okay, how is this distributed?
Yeah, that was they really weren't willing to share a lot of information about that with us yesterday. Whether it was being sent through the mail or being distributed just on the streets or through, you know, they said it was, you know, these cartridges were turning up in area high schools and elsewhere. So, but it still isn't clear how they were doing the distribution.
So you mentioned that Operation Milwaukee, now this one in Bristol that was the products were seen in Waukesha County. Is there a thought that this might just be the tip of the iceberg, that there may be a lot more operations out there like this?
I think that's what it really is looking like and sounding like. And sources have told us in the past, we've been working on, I've been writing about vaping since 2015, I think, you know, for a long time. And sources have said that this cartridge market is underground cartridge market is really prevalent in some of the states where cannabis is illegal. In Colorado, they say it's not, you know, people are not using those cartridges as much, but the appeal of cartridges is because they doesn't smell very much. It's very discreet, unlike, you know, people smoking, you know, in other forms, you know, that's very pungent and very obvious when people are smoking. So this is a stealthy way, which really appeals to teenagers and you know, and younger people who are trying to do it, you know, secretly.
Does that make law enforcement tough here, given that THC products are legal in other states?
Right. I mean, I think from the law enforcement standpoint, you know, it's illegal to be distributing this stuff, even, you know, from legal state to legal state. You can't be mailing it. You're not supposed to be sending it through the mail. You're not supposed to be, you know, crossing state lines. So, you know, I think in Wisconsin, it's, you know, it's very clear that this is in any shape or form is not legal.
And let's talk about the packaging. One thing I forgot to ask you about earlier, when somebody gets a hold of one of these cartridges, what does the packaging make it look like?
Yeah, that is really interesting. Well, this counterfeit packaging is available online, which makes these operations, you know, very easy. There's stuff all over Amazon and different, not even just on the dark web, but it's very readily available to get packaging for some of the stuff. And it's like, looks like flavored candy. It's some great flavor. I mean, there are Sour Patch flavors. There's all sorts of things that make it look like it's just harmless and geared toward, you know, young people for the most part, and doesn't actually have the ingredients that are in line with what is actually in the package.
Did I see one package in at least one of these two cases included a Girl Scout cookie flavor?
Yes, that is correct. Girl Scout cookie flavor. We've seen grape. We've seen the Sour Patch. All sorts of, you know, candy-like flavors.
And when it comes to the THC levels, do the packages say anything about, yeah, there's THC in this cartridge?
Well, they do, and it was kind of confusing with the way the police were laying it out yesterday. They were talking about like the level, the amount of THC versus like sort of the concentration. These cartridges hold about a gram, and so 1,000 milligrams of THC oil. But what was also unclear, and they don't know, is like what else these things contained. Were they cutting the oil with any other ingredient? That's something they sent out to the labs to be tested. So we don't know that yet.
As you say, Raquel, you've been following vaping since 2015. What is the next piece of the story you're watching for now?
Well, really, we're really eager to find out specifically what's causing the lung damage. There's, you know, flavoring chemicals we've been writing about for a long time are known to cause serious lung damage in, you know, occupational settings. And so we're just, you know, that's going to be really important, what specifically is causing this.
Raquel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for your interest in this story.
Raquel Rutledge is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked with us about an illegal vaping cartridge operation in Kenosha County that police uncovered last week. Two brothers believed to be running that operation are now in custody. It all comes as public health officials are trying to determine what link there could be between bootleg vaping products and cases of lung disease around the country. Now, the news update you've been waiting for about the word the. A couple weeks back, I told you about an effort by the Ohio State University to get a trademark on the use of the word the. Ohio State was hoping to have exclusive use of the word exclusively on their athletic apparel. Yesterday, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office sent a letter to the Ohio State University legal team. The answer, no. As reported at Cleveland.com, there were two reasons for the rejection. Reason A, Ohio State was too slow. The fashion company Marc Jacobs had already applied for its own trademark to use the word "the" on clothing and accessories 3 months before Ohio State. And reason two, the word "the" would be, quote, merely a decorative or ornamental feature of applicants' clothing, end quote. Therefore, it would not be a distinctive branding item deserving of a trademark. The decision is not final. Ohio State has 6 months to respond. They're considering their options. In the meantime, "the" is out. They've got three more words in their name they can try to trademark. Ohio, you know, they can have it if they want, as far as I'm concerned. State, there's a lot of states that might run into a little trouble on that one. And university. They can own the word university on their paraphernalia and gear. I can't see any problem with that. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.